And this is indeed Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, and we're streaming live at freakradio.org. Go to the main page, which is now somewhat consolidated from its earlier version. It should be a little easier for you to see what's right in front of you and follow the instructions for our free streaming link if you're not listening to us on your little radio sets there. And don't forget that if you can't find us on the airwaves at 101.3, then we're still going to be streaming either live or recorded, but we are continually streaming 24 hours, 7 days a week, and all that. So it's if you can't find us on one venue, check the other. We're still alive and going and looking forward to our 20th anniversary next March. This is the Mideast Migraine Show.
I had my stomach pumped 2 times my senior year, which earned the approbation of all my plastered fears. Now I do my weekly bleeding at trendy AA meetings. I was a social monster, but now I serve my sponsor. I choke out cliche confessions. I suck down coffee black and I chain smoke cigarettes in between handfuls of Prozac. Man, in my one sober stallion, I just got my first medallion. My higher power drug me. I'm letting strangers hug me. Sufficient dependency still coursing through my blood. I'm only changing drugs. Self-help study, 12-step program. Which hollow slogan was it? We find serenity in day by day, or easy does it? Plant that affirmation seed. Our license plate should be 10,000 lakes and treatment centers. Ready for to statewide mentor. They say the devil's in the details of this cunning, baffling habit. I poured out all my NyQuil. I flushed my sonic tablets. Don't take others' inventory. Thanks for sharing your sick story. My bluff, I know they'll call it. I'm Stuart, I'm an alcoholic. Dysfunction breeds the strangest sages, quoting pointless daily phrases. The self-sufficient dependency still coursing through my blood. I'm only changing drugs. Self-perpetuating business, you can't cure a lifelong sickness. Hazled and cleaned out my parents, but my stay was 14 carat. Inner peace is what we see. $100 a week. Treatment's just a new psychosis. Need and weakness through hypnosis. The big book is omniscient, and I'm not self-sufficient. Dependency still coursing through my blood. I'm only changing drugs. I'm only changing drugs.
At the baseball park on Pigment Street, me and all my friends would meet. Some were fat and some were thin, but all of them had creamy skin. And I never saw an Asian, I never met a black. You really never noticed when you're living in a vacuum. My one a coincidence that every kid that's moved in since within is just like me. Anglo-Saxon, but we all learned my private school for the upper middle class. I learned like each good Christian does how evil segregation was. But there was absence of variety and no uncertain terms. My cordoned off society was zero in the terms. On Martin Luther King Day, school was off and we would play our identical homes. Teams of monochrome in my little white town. I never had a black friend. Everybody was an Anglo-Saxon. We all learned diversity is grace. Out of all those vanilla faces, I never saw a single one at time. Hey, could you rig it? Bring me a little black friend so I can prove I'm no bigot. But my rich neighbors will tell you mixed blood lowers property value. They fear someday perhaps they'll pierce this suburban capsule.
Hey, folks. Yes, it is indeedy time for the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Lawrence Wren Tawil. You may put that Wren spelled R-E-N in quotes if it'll help you understand. That's my nickname. I am Wren. Host of the Mideast Migraine Show, and we are coming to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Broadcasting in 101.3 FM and streaming live at freakradio.org. The Monday edition. I also have a Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines beginning at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Even when we're doing daylight savings, it's always at 11, and this show is always on Mondays at 3 p.m., 1,500 hours. Also Pacific time. Now, just a quick note. It's time to start a new book reading after about a month hiatus from the more formally printed up stuff. I was concentrating on the nature and the history of Zionism and the discussion of implementing Zionism and what that means is the philosophy and the movement behind establishing a homeland for the Jewish people, and actually exclusively for the Jewish people. There was some question in the early stages of the discussion as to where in the world exactly that would be, but before long it predictably centered on Palestine, which is the ancient homeland of many, many different peoples, and the ancient Hebrew people were by no means the first ones to live there. But as I said, I was talking about Zionism and colonialism and how discussion of anti-Semitism or hatred for Jews and their religious faith fits in there one way or another often ends up being the case. That was the Saturday show. Now we're done with that series of shows, and on the Saturday show at 11 a.m. I will essentially be beginning a new book. Now, the book is entitled Freedom Sailors. It's the story of the human rights movement, Palestinian Solidarity Movement, that was founded around 2006, I believe. And after 2 years of a lot of hard work, outreach, networking, social networking, both on and off the internet, and a hell of a lot of donations, we finally succeeded in getting two boats, former fishing boats, in the Mediterranean Sea to be crewed by 44 solidarity activists. We sailed from the port of Larnaca on the island of Cyprus into the port of Gaza City in the Gaza Strip. And that's what the book is all about. It's a very near and dear subject to me because, yes, as I'm sure some of you have heard before, I was one of those participants in August of 2008. And but the thing is, there's one slight proviso I have to slip in here. Before actually beginning the book, I expect to be doing an interview with one of the co-editors of that book. Her name is Greta Berlin. She is also co-founder of the Free Gaza Movement, the sponsor of the two vessels and several and many, many more which followed. The voyage of those two ships, which happened to travel successfully between those two geographical points. Now, Greta, at my latest understanding, lives in France, and we're going to be doing an interview with Greta Berlin. And she expects to have her, the attorney for the Free Gaza Movement, with her. So I'll have, we expect to have two people on the other end of the line for that Skype interview. That's this Saturday, December 6th, at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. So that's what that's about. I was going to give you a short PSA here, but I see that that's old by about 10 days. So I'm just going to dish out a number of items I've been collecting recently. Come on, you. And then we're going to begin with, as some of you know, I'm fond of the dispatches that I receive from the United Nations News Center. Ban Ki-moon, a Korean gentleman, is the Secretary General of the UN, has been for some years now. Ban Ki-moon is his name. Ban applauds Tunisian presidential vote as country's democratic transition continues. Tunisia, in North Africa, wedged in there between Libya and Algeria, I believe, was the first in a string of some half dozen or so, if not more, democratically emerging Arab states. This was known as the Arab Spring some three and a half, four years ago. You know, just on our Western media, we receive virtually nothing but the bad news. When it came Egypt's turn soon after Tunisia's broaching of the Arab Spring protest activities, pro-democracy activities, this also happened in Egypt. Over 300 people were killed by government forces who were protesting for freedom. Right now, Egypt still, without a doubt, has a long way to go. But overall, to me, it's encouraging because over the course of some 3.5-4 years, Egypt, there's been a lot of activity on the internet and a lot of intellectual activity. And even though the government is still a mess there, it's still a center for all things Arabic, as Egypt generally is. It's considered more or less the capital of the Arab world there in that country's capital city of Cairo. Tunisia, as I started to say, was the first in the series of Arab Spring participants. This is dated November 24. Let's see what we get here. Okay, that doesn't want to flesh out. It's been a rough week, folks. As you've often heard me complain about before. Oh, gosh. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it just refuses to. I'll just read you the first half paragraph, all right? Again, Ban Ki-moon, UN General Secretary, applauds the Tunisian presidential vote as the country's democratic transition continues. Ban Ki-moon today extended his congratulations to the people of Tunisia on the occasion of their first presidential election since revolution swept the country and ushered in an era of democratic change. Legislative elections held in the North African country on 26 October, welcoming the polls as a, quote, crucial step for the country's future and a decisive milestone in the transition to democracy. You see, again, we hear basically nothing about Tunisia on the mainstream electronic and print news media here in the Western world. And so I just wanted everyone to take note of the fact that it's still happening to some degree or another in Tunisia. That's going on. All right. Here we go. Here's the article. It decided to pop up 27 October 2014, the original date of the report, by the UN News Center. A statement from Mr. Ban: just as this moment comes with a great deal of hope, there remain a number of crucial tasks ahead for the next government. Mr. Ban added in a statement issued by a spokesperson, the United Nations stands ready to support Tunisia in this respect. The Secretary General visited Tunisia in mid-October, meeting with President Moncef Marzouki and pledging the organization's full support for the North African nation as it continues along the road to democracy. Last January, that's technically 11 whole months ago, Tunisia's parliament adopted the constitution, the country's first since massive public demonstrations ousted President Zine El Abidine Bel Ali in early 2011. The first regime to be toppled in the so-called Arab Spring. In his statement, Mr. Ban also extended his congratulations to the Tunisian electoral authorities for their efforts in organizing the polling and for their continued work on the presidential election scheduled for next month. Okay, you know, another rather bland dispatch from the UN, and it's off-stated support for positive steps taken by nations around the world to upgrade into a truly civil democratization as the world continues its rather rickety ascent into the democratic statehood here. I just wanted to get that out of the way so I can get that out of the way. Jewish Voice for Peace. This also on November. You know, that's probably okay. Also says November 24 here. Week ago. 1 week ago. Jewish Voice for Peace is boasting here about how there are growing leaps and bounds. How Jewish Voice for Peace became one of the fastest growing Jewish organizations in America. Chapter growth is represented here in a vague map of the U.S., 41 current chapters, 72 total chapters. By current chapters, they must mean recent additions to this, but they have 72 total JVP chapters, and but an additional 31 chapters in development. This week, we, the JVP, sent thousands of supporters our print newsletter describing JVP's record-breaking growth in chapters, supporters, and followers, and what that inspiring growth will allow us to do. After we sent the newsletter to the printers, the situation in Israel and Palestine continued to crush our hearts. Even more, with a number of horrific attacks on Jewish Israelis and increasingly brazen Israeli government repression of Palestinians. Of course, that's always been going on. And that includes, by the way, repression of Palestinian citizens of Israel. Israel does not even like to refer to them as Palestinians or even as Israeli Palestinians. They are, in the minds of many Jewish Israelis, Israeli Arabs. And, of course, they put the word Israel first. They don't want to say Arab Israelis. But they are indeed Palestinian Arabs in reality. It says here, meanwhile, the steady drumbeat of inconceivable yet routine Israeli military shootings of Palestinians continues, while largely being ignored in the press. And no time can heal the wounds of this summer in Gaza. The winter encroaches while a stunning 100,000 Palestinians remain displaced. 1/10 of a million Palestinians are without their own homes. That, of course, those are the survivors. Over 2,000 of them died in last summer's attack by Israel upon the Strip. It says here, in some ways, taking a moment to be inspired by our growth may feel dissonant when we are reminded of these horrors, but it is precisely this growth in the uprising for equality and fairness clearly unfolding in Jewish and other communities across America that gives many of us the most hope of all. Cecily Sharasky, Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace. And they have a postscript here. Obviously, they're still plugging away for donations. That's what this is getting at. It says, the PS says, we may not have the budget, but with passion and truth on our side, we're leaving AIPAC in the dust. AIPAC refers to the primary Israeli lobby in Washington, which really should not be a legitimate lobby in the truest legal sense of the world. But no one is able or has the guts to force the issue that AIPAC should be a, what do they call it, a foreign entity, a foreign agent, a foreign entity with representation in Washington to get their point across, and they're begging for U.S. dollars, American taxpayer dollars, namely. But instead, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, continues to act in highly questionable status as a normal American political lobby. Okay, so it continues to say here, we're leaving AIPAC in the dust. As of this morning, we've got nearly 200,000 Facebook followers, with millions seeing our posts regularly. AIPAC can't even break 100,000, and 1.5 million people have watched our videos. Only 1 million have watched theirs. If we had even 1/10 of their $60 million-plus budget, imagine what we could do. So, to reiterate, as I did my last show or two shows ago, JVP is not a sponsor of the Mideast Migraine Show here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Generally, our shows do not have specific corporate or other deep-pocketed sponsors. This is strictly homegrown radio. I am just passing this information from JVP on to you. I receive the items in my personal email account, and I'm letting you in on it. They would appreciate donations. The postal address is Jewish Voice for Peace, 1611 Telegraph Avenue, Suite 550, Oakland, California, zip code 94612. They are at jewishvoiceforpeace.org. You can try just typing in jvp.org, see what that does, and you can find out all you need to know about donations there, or general information email addresses, info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org, info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. I do not mind bringing that message along to you at all. This from the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Pro-Israel groups want to stifle academic freedom. This is a terrible ongoing problem, including here in Santa Cruz, California, the central left coast of the United States. Ten years ago, Campus Watch, a pro-Israel organization attempting to blacklist professors sympathetic to Palestinian rights, pushed legislation to install a government-appointed advisory board to weed out criticism of Israel in campus Middle East studies programs receiving federal government funds. Back then, we at the U.S. campaign against the occupation, we formed a coalition of 100 groups and successfully beat back this McCarthyite effort. But similar groups such as the Brandeis Center and the AMCHA Initiative are at it again, this time pressing the Department of Education to monitor the content of these educational programs and to defund those that don't have, and this is in quotations, diverse perspectives. Through sketchy methodology, bogus congressional quotes, and an erroneous conflation of legitimate criticism of Israel's policies with anti-Semitism, these groups falsely claim that Middle East studies programs receiving government funding are laced with anti-Israel bias and even anti-Semitism, and should therefore be defunded for lacking, quote-unquote, diverse perspectives. It's urgent that we mobilize again to defeat this latest attempt of the pro-Israel thought police to shred academic freedom and banish any and all criticism of Israel from campus. And I will add, referring to even the most responsible, thoughtful, and documented or backed up criticism of Israel. They want to banish that from campus as well. The campaign against the occupation wants everyone to take a minute to write to Education Secretary Arne Duncan and your members of Congress, in whichever part of the state you're in, whichever state you're in. This is a national U.S. effort here. Write them to state your support for academic freedom in federally funded Middle East studies programs and your opposition to the government monitoring and passing judgment on the content of university education. It says here, we'd laugh off the Brandeis Center and AMCHA Initiative reports, which are debunked in this excellent FAQ published by member group Middle East Research and Information Project. We'd laugh them off if it weren't for the fact that members of Congress are using them to advance the effort to stifle criticism of Israel on campus. In fact, Representative Nita Lowey, Democrat of New York, an ardent supporter of Israel, parroted the false claims in these reports, insisting to Duncan, Education Secretary Arne Duncan, that Middle East studies programs are, and I quote, disproportionately focused on and are biased against Israel, could, quote, engender anti-Semitism and should be defunded, says Representative Lowey. Members of Congress, such as Lowey, may even attempt to write this thought policing into law by amending Title VI of the Higher Education Act, which funds language and area studies at universities, when it comes up for reauthorization soon. That's why we urgently need you to help head off this effort before it gathers any more momentum. Now, if you go to, if you Google U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, or some such similar lineup of words, you will find out more about this, and you'll be able to use the engine they have on their website to send a letter to Secretary Duncan and your members of Congress. This dispatch goes on. Let's be real. The last thing these pro-Israel groups want is diverse perspectives on campus. What they want to do is quash all academic criticism of Israel, as evidenced by recent witch hunts against Professor Rabab Abdulhadi and Professor Stephen Salaita. What they aim to accomplish is to stamp out all student activism in support of human rights, as evidenced by unwarranted repression against Students for Justice in Palestine chapters on campuses such as Florida Atlantic University, Northeastern University, Loyola, and many others. Make no mistake about it, these efforts by pro-Israel groups to stifle voices and smother campus activism are tactics of desperation. Persuasive evidence that even these groups admit that Israel can no longer be defended. But of course, these groups still enjoy much clout, which is why we need you today to help us push back on this effort to monitor and defund Middle East studies programs. Thanks for taking action to support academic freedom. Sincerely, Josh Rubner, the policy director of the U.S. campaign. Postscript. The University of California at Los Angeles, one of the universities targeted by these reports, responds that they are based on, quote, incomplete statistical evidence, which take snippets of talks given by invited speakers and present them out of context, and use ad hominem attacks against respected scholars that verge on the libelous, end quote. And you can read UCLA's takedown at the website for U.S. campaign. And that, of course, is, you can find that at www.endtheoccupation.org. Just click, just go to endtheoccupation.org or Google End the Occupation. More info, you may send your messages to U.S. campaign at endtheoccupation.org. You know, I always wonder whenever I talk about issues like this and I give contact information, whether I'm doing more harm than good to the cause, to the good guy cause here. The good guys being those who are promoting peace, justice, and reconciliation for all people who have been hurt by this terrible debacle between various Arabs and the state of Israel. You know, some will hear what I have to say, and they may unduly take advantage of the contact information that I pass along on my program and do gosh knows what with them. Well, we just, that's comes with the territory, folks, in this field of activity that I'm involved with. We just have to take our chances. We cannot remain silent, can we? All right. Now, I can't remember if I happened to mention in any of my reports in recent weeks that, lo and behold, the Israeli manufacturing facility, which is located illegally on an illegal Israeli Jews-only settlement, Jewish-only settlement in illegally militarily occupied territory, which is supposed to be free Palestine here. Pretty much everyone else in the world says so. The people who manufacture SodaStream there have decided to move that operation out of that facility. At least the operation that manufactures the SodaStream water carbonation for residential home use device, which is sold in a number of outlets even here in Santa Cruz County, California. It's marketed in the U.S., Canada, and other places around the world. Sometimes labeling the packaging, or even perhaps even the item itself, the SodaStream carbonation device, as made in Israel or manufactured in Israel, which in actuality it is manufactured on the illegal settlements in the West Bank. Okay, we're having the same old darn problem as before. Okay. This, by the way, is also brought to us by way of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, people. Here's a somewhat of a repetition, more formal declaration of what's going on. The SodaStream month of action has come and gone. Admittedly, I didn't say anything about it in November. Oh, wait, no, it hasn't. Jeez, I got my 11s mixed up with my 12s. We're in the middle. Actually, quite at the very beginning of the SodaStream month of action. Started November 28th and goes to December 24th. SodaStream month of action by Ramah Kudaimi, membership and outreach coordinator of the U.S. campaign. Participate in boycott actions during the month of action. Last month, SodaStream, an Israeli company that manufactures home carbonating devices, announced that in 2015 it was going to be relocating its factory, currently based in an illegal settlement in the West Bank. The company has been the target of boycott campaigns worldwide for exploiting Palestinian land, labor, and resources. SodaStream has had a rough year as its stock price has been dropping and its revenues decreasing. This news, yes, folks, it's been working. If you're familiar with the BDS campaign against Israel, much of Israeli life, cultural, academic, and some of its economic endeavors, and are familiar with the word SodaStream, it's been working. It's like he's telling us here, this news is just the latest sign that global BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns are having an impact on companies that profit from Israeli occupation and apartheid. SodaStream organizers are gearing up to do a month of action November 28th, Black Friday, through December 24th, to keep the pressure on the company until it actually shuts down the factory and to let consumers know that until that happens, its products are still being manufactured in an illegal settlement. This is also until they shut down and move, which will be next year. Hasn't happened yet. It's important to remember. We get these announcements, and we tend to have a tendency to say, oh, that's it, it's all over. No. They'll give you dates, some future dates, months, sometimes many months in the future, such as when CVS, V as in Victor, drugstores and pharmacies declared roughly a year ago that as of this past October, they were going to discontinue selling tobacco and at least certain tobacco-related products. No more cigarettes and hopefully no more cigars. Well, the October deadline has come and gone. I tend to presume that CVS has lived up to that. But the thing is, they made the announcement in plenty of time for them to adjust for the what for them is a very minor economic loss, since they rake in billions in profit every year. And so you got to keep an eye out for when things are actually going to happen. Okay. And the dispatch continues to say, this is also an opportunity to bring attention to the role SodaStream's factory in the Nakab, or the Negev Desert, plays in the Israeli government's plans to displace Palestinian Bedouins and the unfair labor practices in that factory that impact their workers, many of whom are Bedouin women. You can start making your own plans, too. And again, if you go to the U.S. campaign website, you will see a variety of things you can do to spread the word and to do something positive with this SodaStream month of action through most of the rest of this now new month of December. This is December 1st, in the year 2014. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, and we are streaming live. At freakradio.org, freakradio.org. That's 3:41 in the afternoon, this Monday, December 1st. Okay, let's move along here. More on that on said boycott. I really do got a bunch of things to talk to you about. I do have some difficulty in organizing them because my email account doesn't do everything as well as certain other email accounts. Okay, let's move along to Yuri Avneri, a constant contributing columnist for Israel's premier news periodical Haaretz. Haaretz. The writing is so tiny. Yeah, I don't think I've read this one to you. This is dated 14 November. Yuri Avneri. Wine, Blood, and Gasoline. The View from Israel. Jesus turned water into wine. Netanyahu is turning water into gasoline and pouring it on the flames. Again, by Jewish Israeli author, writer, Yuri Avneri. Fasten your seatbelts. Kafir Kana, a village near Nazareth, is probably the place where Jesus, according to the New Testament, turned water into wine. Now it is the Arab village where the Israeli police is turning stones into blood. On the fateful day, the police were confronting a group of young Arabs protesting against the Israeli efforts to change the status quo on the Temple Mount, which is known to Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary. Such demonstrations were taking place that day in many Arab towns and villages all over Israel, and especially in occupied East Jerusalem. According to the first police statement, the 22-year-old Arab, Khair Adin Hamdan, attacked the police with a knife. In self-defense, they had no choice but to shoot him and kill him. As so often with police reports, this was a pack of lies. Unfortunately for the police, the incident was recorded by security cameras. The pictures clearly showed Hamdan approaching a police car and beating on its windows with something, possibly a knife. When he saw that this had no effect, Hamdan turned around and started to walk away. That, again, this was caught on a security camera. At that moment, the policeman got out of the car and immediately started to shoot at the back of Hamdan, who was hit and fell to the ground. The officer surrounded him and, after some hesitation, obviously a consultation between them, between the policeman, started to drag the wounded youngster on the ground towards the patrol car as if he were a sack of potatoes. They dumped him on the floor of the car and drove away to a hospital, it appears, with their feet on or near the dying man. The pictures show clearly for everyone to see that the policemen violated the standing police orders, for opening fire. They were in no immediate mortal danger. They did not shout a warning. They did not shoot first in the air, and they did not aim at the lower part of his body. Let me just clarify this. Highly mythologized practice of police or IDF Israeli troops shooting at the feet or the lower extremities of the body before they shoot at the trunk or take more lethal action. is that story is given all the time, a lot of cases, particularly in the cases of demonstrations, which always start off peacefully with the Palestinians, at least organized protests, rallies, and demos. And that's a bunch of malarkey we receive most of the time when people who are trying to defend Israel and their so-called defense forces try to say, well, they have orders to shoot at the feet first. They may have those orders, but that's generally not what they do. Sometimes these defenders of Israel will outright lie or speak out of ignorance when they say they did shoot at the feet first or the lower extremities first, whether they know what they're talking about or not. So anyway, I will continue here. The police were in no immediate mortal danger. They did not shout a warning. They did not shoot first in the air, and they did not aim at the lower part of his body. They did not call an ambulance. The youngster bled to death. It was a cold-blooded execution, says Abneri here as I continue his article. There was an outcry. Arab citizens rioted in many places. Under pressure, the Police Investigation Board, which belongs to the Ministry of Justice, started an investigation. The first investigation already uncovered several facts which put an even more severe face on the incident. It appeared that before the camera caught the scene, the police had arrested Hamdan's cousin and put him into the car. Obviously, Carradine wanted to release the cousin and therefore beat on the car. The cousin saw him being shot and dumped on the floor of the car in which he was sitting. The first reaction of the police command was to justify the behavior of the policeman, whose names and faces are withheld. They were spirited away to some other police unit. Author here, Yuri Abneri, says, I describe the incident at length not because it is unique, but on the contrary, because it is so typical, Abneri says. What was special about it was only the unnoticed presence of the camera. Several cabinet ministers of the Israeli cabinet lauded the exemplary behavior of the police in this incident. This can be dismissed as the publicity hunting of extreme right-wing demagogues who believe that their voters approve of all and any shooting of Arabs. They would know. However, one statement cannot be ignored, the one made by the Minister of Home Security. A few days before the incident, Minister Yitzhak Aharonovitz, a protege of Avigdor Lieberman and himself a former police officer, declared publicly that he did not want any terrorist to survive after an attack. That is a manifestly illegal statement. Indeed, it is a call for crimes. Under the law, policemen are not allowed to shoot quote-unquote terrorists, or anybody else after they are taken prisoner, especially when they are wounded and do not present any quote-unquote mortal danger. Aharonovitz always seems a nice guy. He has a knack of popping up before the cameras after every newsworthy incident, whether a severe road accident, a political crime, or a fire. God knows how he manages that. In actual fact, the Minister for Home Security, formerly known as Minister of Police, has practically no function. Since the days of the British Mandate, up until the middle of 1948, the commander of the police force has been the Inspector General, a uniformed professional officer. The sole police function of the minister is to recommend to the government the appointment of a new commander. But for ordinary policemen, a statement by the minister sounds like an order. Quite probably, the irresponsible utterance of the minister was a direct incitement to the crime of Kafir Khana, especially since neither the Inspector General nor the Prime Minister denounced it. All this reminds one of the fateful 1984 utterance of then Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who also declared that no terrorist should stay alive after an attack. The direct result was the Bus Line 300 affair, in which four Arab boys, without any weapons, hijacked an Israeli bus. They were stopped. Two were shot during the recapture, and two were taken alive. One of them was murdered by the chief of the Shin Bet himself, Avraham Shalom. And yes, Shalom is the Hebrew word for peace. Who crushed his skull with a rock. The chief of Shin Bet, Avraham Shalom, crushed the Arab boy's skull with a rock. When the pictures were published, first by me, Yuri Avneri, Shalom and his colleagues were pardoned. Shamir denied any responsibility. Back to today's events. Is this the long-awaited third intifada? Yes? No? Army and police officers, politicians, and especially media commentators are busy trying to answer this question. Intifada, by the way, means literally shaking off, as in shaking off your oppressor. This is not just a mere semantic game. The definition carries with it operational consequences. As a matter of fact, the entire country, Israel, is now aflame. East Jerusalem is already a war zone, with daily demonstrations, riots, and bloodshed. In Israel proper, since the Kafir Khana killing, Arab citizens are also mounting daily strikes and demonstrations. In the West Bank, there are some demonstrations and a fatal stabbing, after which an Arab was shot and killed. Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, is doing everything in his power to prevent a general uprising, which might quite well endanger his regime. But pressure from below is mounting. Abbas refused to meet Netanyahu in Amman, the capital of Jordan. Popular wisdom in Israel has already found a name for the situation. Intifada of individuals. For the Israeli security chiefs, that is a nightmare. They are ready for an organized intifada. They know how to quash it by force and, if necessary, by more force. But what to do with an intifada, which is entirely made by isolated individuals, with no orders from any organization, with no grouping that can be infiltrated by the collaborators of the Shin Bet net of informers? That's a question there. But what to do with an intifada, which is entirely made by isolated individuals, not mass intifada, with no orders from any organization, with no grouping that can be infiltrated by the collaborators of the Shin Bet net of informers? An individual Arab listens to the news, is incensed by the latest outrage against the holy shrines, and drives his car into the nearest group of Israeli soldiers or civilians, or takes a knife from the kitchen of the Israeli restaurant where he washes the dishes and stabs people in the street. No prior information, no network can be infiltrated. Quite frustrating. The center of the storm is the Temple Mount. The Al-Aqsa, or Far Away Mosque, the third holiest place of Islam, is under siege. At one point, Israeli soldiers entered the mosque with their boots on. I take that to mean that is a religious transgression, a blasphemous thing to wear boots or perhaps any shoes or sandals on the carpet of a mosque. So, at one point, Israeli soldiers entered the mosque with their boots on in pursuit of stone-throwing demonstrators. Where are we going? For decades now, a group of Israeli zealots has been busy planning for a new Jewish temple to be built in place of the Al-Aqsa and the magnificent Dome of the Rock. They are stitching garments for priests and making the necessary preparations for animal sacrifices, says Yuri Avneri here. Until recently, they were considered simply a curiosity. Not anymore. Several cabinet ministers and Knesset members have entered the holy enclosure to pray. Contrary to the status quo, throughout the Islamic world, this has aroused alarm. Palestinians in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and in Israel proper are furious. Netanyahu promised King Abdullah II to restore quiet. I believe Abdullah is the king of Jordan. Netanyahu promised Abdullah to restore quiet, but he is doing the opposite. Jesus turned water into wine. Netanyahu is turning water into gasoline and pouring it on the flames. And, I offer an apology here. Whenever I see the name Yuri Avneri, I automatically gravitate towards Haaretz news magazine. Haaretz is not mentioned anywhere here. The associated website is OutlookIndia.com. OutlookIndia.com/article/wine, blood, and gasoline with the hyphens all in there. So apparently that's where that comes from. Also some mention here of netvision.net.israel. Yeah, I've been holding on to that one for about 2 weeks. He's a good writer, very honest, dedicated to the truth. At the United Nations, a Palestinian-born designer uses fashion to show, quote, another face of homeland. Fashion designer. Wow, very colorful, stunning photograph here of models wearing, presumably, this guy's designs. 11 November. Through fashion, quote, a universal language. Palestinian-born designer Jamal Taslak unveiled his fall-winter collection at United Nations headquarters in New York last night, spotlighting his long-troubled homeland, but also revealing another face of Palestine, quote-unquote, inspired and inspiring, yearning to be at peace. And a quotation from the man here, "It's a pleasure for me this evening to represent my people with this kind of art. Fashion is a universal language. It is a way to show the world and people that fashion can be used to show another face of Palestine," Mr. Taslak said in an interview with United Nations Radio, ahead of the fashion show, one of several events at headquarters in the run-up to the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People, observed annually on 29 November. Let me break in here. Why 29 November? It was on that date in 1947, November the 29th, that the United Nations passed and adopted a plan to partition the former British Mandate of Palestine, although quite frankly the mandate was still in place until the 14th of May of the next year. But it was the UN, and this is a way of apologizing to the native Palestinian Arabs there that they did this to begin with. There were a bunch of, Jewish Zionists who wanted to establish the Jewish-only homeland in Palestine, who cobbled that partition plan together. They drew the lines, which actually gave them slightly over half of Palestine, some 56 or 57% of Palestine, to what the UN referred to as the Jewish state area, the remaining 44 or so percent to be designated the Arab state area. 44% for the Arabs, which ended up being 22% by the end of the fighting in the first couple of months of 1949. Less than a quarter was retained by the Palestinian Arabs as Israeli partisans, militant partisans, gobbled up significant portions of the Arab state area and illegally include them in the Jewish state area. They hide behind this business of the neighboring Arab states attacking Israel, even though a number of them first entered through the Arab state area, sent their armies into the Arab state area because they had to drive them out of there first. the Jews were already controlling first Jewish neighborhoods in the Arab state area and then former Arab villages that they pressured those Arabs out of. So, you know, they don't tell you that they were the Zionists were already involved in significant fighting and conquering before the Arab nations invaded on the 15th of May in 1948. Anyway, okay, I'm really wagging my tongue a lot about some history there. Let's get back to this. So, the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people is observed every year on November 29th. On with this UN dispatch. Born in Nablus, I'm just trying to verify. I'm not sure if this is a regular UN News Center dispatch or not, but it continues here. Born in Nablus in 1970, Mr. Tazlak realized at the young age of 12 that he wanted to be a fashion designer and work with fabrics and embroidery. When he finished high school, Mr. Tazlak left for Jordan to study design and soon after moved to Italy in 1990. He says here, "When I left Palestine, I understood that I must do something for me and my people to show the world that we are the same as other people. We want a life. We want peace. We want love. We love. We have all the feelings that make us the same as other people," he said, Mr. Tazlak said, currently based in Rome. He says he feels like he lives in a museum and is constantly inspired by his surroundings. Referring, of course, to the city of Rome. He is also very much inspired by his diverse clientele in the Middle East, Europe, and the United States. Crafted in Italy, Mr. Tazlak's designs offer a modern reinterpretation of ancient traditional Palestinian embroideries while combining modern Italian style. His latest collection, he says, pays tribute to his homeland. The collection includes 30 evening gowns, cocktail dresses, and tailored suits, all characterized by Mr. Tazlak's geometric cuts. The fabrics used are silk, chiffon, crepe, and georgette. No, I have... This is the first time I've ever come across the word georgette myself here, either. The predominant colors are white, ivory, red, green, and black. Overwhelmingly reminiscent of the flag of Palestine. White, red, green, and black in particular. Mr. Tazlak credits refugees in a camp in Jerash, Jordan, with helping create or who helped create some of the embroideries used in the collection. Last night's runway finale featured a wedding dress entirely hand-embroidered, festooned with beads of olive wood, inlaid with stones of gold, ivory, and mother of pearl, and finished with silk thread. The combination evokes the elements of the land, hearkening back to Tazlak's roots. "When I went to the camps in Palestine, the refugee camps, I told everybody, you must do what you want to do. It's important. I know many people live in not good situations, but with a little help from everybody, we can help them. They can do more and more," he says. In November 2013, just last year, the UN General Assembly proclaimed the entire year of 2014 as the International Year of Solidarity with the Palestinian People, IYSPP. I earlier spoke of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People on 29 November. This is the International Year of Solidarity with them. Since then, since the proclamation, the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People has organized various activities to raise awareness of obstacles to the ongoing peace process, such as settlements, Jewish settlements, and the blockade of Gaza. A Palestinian fashion designer. I mean, like, they're terrorists, right? they're just terrorists in disguise, wolf in sheep's clothing, which is exactly the words of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. He would have you think, no matter what they're doing, if they're Palestinians, this is just another form of propaganda terrorism, trying to make themselves look like everybody else, even though they really are everybody else, like everyone. We're all Palestinians at heart, right? Right. That they're really terrorists. That's the kind of mentality that the poor man, Mr. Tazlak, and his associates undoubtedly have to deal with time and time again. Now, yet another article here about the United Nations. Out of the, quote, darkness, the quote-unquote darkness, UN War Crimes Commission records go public in Washington. Just going to grab a little water here. Okay, 11 November. On the heels of an announcement yesterday that the records of the United Nations War Crimes Commission were made open to the public for the first time in 70 years, in 70 years, a panel discussion examining the historical significance and potential use of the records was held this afternoon at UN headquarters in New York. Yesterday, the records of the UN War Crimes Commission, which was operational between 1943 and 1948 and played a vital role in preparations for the war crimes trials that followed the Second World War, were made open to the public at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Copies of the commission's records were provided to the museum this past July, although they were not freely available to the public until now. Speaking at the panel discussion, United Nations War Crimes Commission records, 1943 to 49, past, present, and future, Adama Deng, U.S. Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, underscored the importance of acknowledging the Commission's legacy in terms of dealing with war crimes today. Quote, the United Nations War Crimes Commission was an important international justice initiative, but its work has largely remained in the darkness, Mr. Deng said. Noting the significance of getting nations to agree so many years ago on setting up a central authority to investigate and make recommendations on war crimes, Mr. Deng said the release of the archives to the public also represents a significant reminder of the importance of gathering and keeping records and bringing perpetrators of war crimes to justice. The failure to hold those accountable can bring down the social fabrics of society and perpetrate mistrust, he said, adding, a fragmented or frustrated society is a society that is more likely to return to violence. I'm going to say that again because that rolls through my head a lot when I think about the Palestinians under occupation. A fragmented or frustrated society is a society that is more likely to return to violence. Quit flapping your fingers on the keyboard there, old Wren. You'd lose your place. The archives of the War Crimes Commission contain evidence submitted by 17 member states, including lists of alleged war criminals, files of charges brought against them, minutes of meetings, reports, correspondence, trial transcripts, and related documentation about the activities of the commission, its committees, and individuals identified as alleged war criminals, including evidence compiled against them and records related to their prosecution by national tribunals. Although some of the information in the documents has long been known to investigators and historians, prior to the commission's records being made available to the museum, the public was unable to view the documents. Researchers at the UN, for instance, must petition for access through their governments, through their respective national governments. In an interview with UN Radio, one of the panelists of today's roundtable, Bridget Sisk, chief of the UN Archives and Management and Records Management Section, underscored the significance of ensuring that a record of what occurred during the commission's time of operation is kept. She stressed, "We hope that the interest that's been generated in the archives of the War Crimes Commission will stimulate greater research in the UN's archives." She went on to say, "We have archives spanning 108 years of history." In other words, going back to World War I. "But we also hope that it stimulates some momentum in the organization among stakeholders to make sure that the digital records the organization is creating today of bodies such as the commission are created and managed appropriately," she added. Speaking during the roundtable, Ms. Sisk highlighted that most of the charges discussed in the commission's records have never been subjected to judicial review. She also noted that the rules regarding access to the records were not seriously challenged until 1986, when, quote, "intense pressure," end quote, led the Secretariat to a review of the policy following allegations that Kurt Waldheim, who served as UN Secretary General from 72 to 81, had himself committed atrocities during the Second World War. Even today, Mr. Sisk, I think I might have said, oh, no, wait a minute. Okay, now it says Mr. Sisk. Even today, Mr. Sisk said the number of requests to the UN for access to the commission's record is strikingly low, averaging 5 or fewer per year. Opening the roundtable, Hua Jiang, officer in charge of the UN Department of Public Information, provided a history of the commission and underscored the importance of the event. And, okay, lots and lots of obviously very accurate reporting and record-keeping here, or documentation, and not terribly exciting. I don't want to lose the few listeners that I have at the moment here. But the important thing is this is a very complete report of the release of the United Nations War Crimes Commission records that they've been keeping for, about 70 years, including items going back to about 108 years ago. The records went public in Washington. I just don't know exactly what they're going to do with those. It's 4:13 in the afternoon here. And you are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org, broadcasting in 101.3 FM. I'm your host, Ren, your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American, bringing you the truth. We'll skip this yet another UN report here. Nah, we don't need that. Thing about Democrats. Let me just repeat this fairly major development, recent development in news from the conflicted Holy Land. This is from the BDS website movement, Freedom, Justice, Equality. This is actually from the Palestinian BDS National Committee. SodaStream to close illegal settlement factory in response to growing boycott campaign. Major Israeli exporter SodaStream has announced it will close its factory that is based in the illegal Israeli settlement of Mishor Adumim, following a high-profile boycott campaign against the company that has seen retailers across Europe and North America drop SodaStream products and the company's share price fall by more than half. The BDS campaign must continue because SodaStream has yet to close its factory and because the company is to benefit from Israel's forcible displacement of Palestinians in the Negev Desert in Israel. And there's a thing here on block the boat effort, blocking Zim, the Israeli cargo shipping company Zim, from docking and unloading its cargo in Oakland, California. I was there for the maiden rally and attempt to block that unloading back in August. Kuwaiti government takes landmark decision to boycott 50 firms over role in apartheid. The government of Kuwait has announced that it will not deal with 50 companies over their role in Israeli violations of international law. Just to point out that it's far more than a SodaStream, which is the target of these BDS campaigns. In this case of the Kuwaiti government's action, the companies include Volvo, the Swedish car maker, Dexia, and Veolia. Kuwaiti authorities recently excluded Veolia from a contract worth $750 million and, quote, all future contracts over its role in the illegal Jerusalem Light Rail project. Illegal because the light rail line, which is actually up and running now, cuts through illegally occupied West Bank territory. Israel excluded from Italy military exercises. The Israeli Air Force has been removed from the list of armed forces now taking part in multinational military training exercises on the Italian island of Sardinia following a campaign by anti-war activists. A call from Gaza, make Israel accountable for its crimes in Gaza and intensifying colonization in the West Bank. In other words, intensify BDS. State-backed Israeli ban faces lively protests in Chile and Argentina and South America, and Jordan civil society demands a boycott of Israel. A short compendium of boycott against Israel-related items there. Okay, I've already read this one. Yeah. Trying to avoid unnecessary repetition. Gaza, the murderous melodrama. I believe I read that too. Gaza, the murderous melodrama by David Shulman, the New York Review of Books. You know, these recorded programs of Mideast migraines are kept as I can keep them up on my personal at-home archive of past episodes, but they're also available on the internet at two websites, radioforall.net, that's radio, R-A-D-I-O, the number four, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. Over the past 72 hours, roughly, Radio for All has been undergoing some technical upgrades, repairs, and improvements. Radio for All is yet another wonderful organization, quite like Free Radio Santa Cruz, which relies entirely on very dedicated volunteer effort. The donations of both computer equipment, drives, and other technical things, not to mention donations of money to keep RadioForAll.net going. And you know how it is with pretty much everything in the physical universe. Things wear out. Drives had recently failed partially. No information lost, from what I understand, but they have to replace these things. And so I wonder if I'm even going to be able to, like I said, it's been roughly the past 3 days that these the problems occurred, were noted, and action was taken. So I'm hoping to be able to record, to upload today's program, or at least recent programs, to that archive. Go to RadioForAll.net, type in Mideast Migraines, or perhaps Mideast Madness for the really older programs, as that was the previous name of this program, Mideast Madness. But for now, let's just count on Mideast Migraines to take you to the most current episodes, where you may hear this article by David Shulman, Gaza, the Murderous Melodrama. If I did read it, and I'm pretty sure I did, it'll be on one of those episodes. So RadioForAll.net is the one of two locations on the net for my archives. My other archives are located at Santa Cruz Indie Media, : Indie Bay. I'm not even sure what all that means, but it's basically Santa Cruz Indie Bay, IndyBay. Santa Cruz Indie Bay also has, a particular note, some recent additions to the long right-hand margin green box there, all labeled Mideast Migraines with other details provided in the title there. So, you know, if I have trouble remembering what I've read to you before, you can just go to my archives and check for yourself. Or for that matter, you can just Google David Shulman, The Murderous Melodrama, or New York Review of Books, and take it from there and looking for it. Okay. J Street. I don't want to talk a whole lot about J Street. I've pretty much given up on J Street, unless it undergoes a very radical alteration in its approach to the problem. J Street is a pro-peace, as they themselves say, a pro-peace, pro-Israel political home, or a political home for pro-Israel, pro-peace Americans. In other words, this is essentially an organization for American Jews who support Palestinian rights, and they also consider themselves to be Zionists. At least that's my understanding. They're certainly pro-Israel. I myself am pro-Israeli in that I don't want to kill nobody. And with some very possible and still looking like very highly unlikely exceptions, no one should have to move anywhere to make room for anybody else. That's my position in Israel and Palestine. More water here. Oh, gosh, that sure helps. You're listening to Mideast Migraines, the Monday edition on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Let that settle in my throat there. Alas, the situation with J Street, as I was getting at, is that in my mind, and from what I read from them, and from what I remember from a J Street event that I attended a year and a half, 2 years ago, here in the city of Santa Cruz, California, it just convinced me that it's inherently contradictory. It's one thing to pronounce yourself as being pro-human rights, hence pro, just as much pro-Palestinian Arab as much as you are Israeli Arab, or pro-Israeli Arab, or pro-Israeli Jew. You can't do that without recognizing that some very important changes must be made in your basic editorial stance and in your charter. Talk about changing charters. Wordings and charters. But I'm going to let me just read this to you now, because I retained this because of the title of this piece here. Election Night Poll. This is dated November 5. And our election this year, I believe, the general election for 2014 in the United States was November 4th, I think, Tuesday the 4th. So, day after that, J Street releases, their president Jeremy Ben-Ami releases election night poll of American Jews, briefing tomorrow on the results. Let's see what this is about. In an election that revealed, remember, this is just immediately post-election, in an election that revealed profound dissatisfaction with the direction of the country, J Street's latest poll of the political attitudes of American Jews showed a community that cares deeply about Israel, but by 2-1, feels the policies of the government of Benjamin Netanyahu are hurting the U.S.-Israel relationship. By 2-1. This says, according to Jews who live in America. Oh, this is hard to read because the paragraph is superimposed on a color picture. Let's see what I can do here. Large majorities of American Jewish voters broadly back President Obama on three major points of contention with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. When it comes to position on settlement expansion, the role of the U.S. in pursuing Israeli-Palestinian peace, and efforts to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, these voters strongly support a hands-on U.S. administration, and twice as many voters say that Netanyahu's policies have hurt Israel's relations with the United States, as believe he's had a positive impact. Twice as many voters say that they've hurt rather than have helped. Fully 85% support active, and they italicize the word, active U.S. efforts to broker an end to the Israeli-Arab conflict. These findings mirror the results from each election since J Street's founding in 2008, American Jews remain a solidly Democratic voting bloc, which is to say, voting with the Democratic Party, and cast their votes with the economy and other bread-and-butter issues in mind. For those of us who support Israel and are committed to its secure and democratic future as a homeland for the Jewish people, the poll provides a clear wake-up call. The policies of the government of Israel regarding Palestinians and a deal with Iran are out of sync with American Jewish opinion. And American Jews see them posing a risk to the U.S.-Israel relationship. American Jewish concern about Israeli policies continues to grow, and with it, so does support for solving key challenges through diplomacy and compromise. Facing a hostile Congress, President Obama has even less room to maneuver on domestic issues than before this election. The data are clear. If he seizes the opportunity to put forward a vision to finally end this conflict, we'll stand behind him. Jeremy Ben-Ami of J Street. Okay. That's important. You know, I recently began, a couple of months ago, I began playing a few, maybe close to some half dozen now, interviews with various personalities who have, various authorities who have something to say about the conflict in Palestine and Israel. And I, once again, I go back and forth between my home computer and this radio studio computer, and that makes it difficult and frustrating to sometimes to get information, to get the proper links that I need in order to bring you these audio interviews. I'm going to take a quick look-see here and see if I can come up with one of those interviews. I was looking at them last night, and I keep forgetting that I don't have the same built-in links on my personal laptop that I have with the one here in the studio. So, Katie Miranda and her Palestine Solidarity Telesummit did offer, I think more than a dozen interviews with these people. I'm just looking for one vital link. Okay. It looks like we're going to hear at least part of an interview. Because we're all so tired of hearing my strained voice. Okay, I don't know how long this is, but we've got a good 23 minutes left. Let's at least begin listening to Jeff Halper. Jeff Halper, an Israeli anthropologist and the coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, an Israeli peace and human rights organization that resists the occupation on the ground and advocates for a just peace between Israel and the Palestinian people. Jeff Halper participated in the first and successful attempt of the Free Gaza movement to break the Israeli siege by sailing into Gaza. He and I were on the same boat. In fact, Jeff and I were buddied for security and safety reasons. So that's where I met the man. He's been to Santa Cruz twice since I moved back here to California, my native California, in 2009. I've seen and heard from him both times. He serves on International Support Committee of the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Palestine and was nominated by the American Friends Service Committee for the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize, nominated for it, together with the Palestinian intellectual and activist Hassan Andoni. Okay. Let me just kick in the password. Sorry that you won't be able to watch it with me, but listen to the words of Jeff Halper and Katie Miranda hosting the interview.
So, welcome to my interview with Jeff Halper. Jeff Halper is an Israeli anthropologist and the coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, an Israeli peace and human rights organization that resists the occupation on the ground and advocates for a just peace between Israel and the Palestinian people. Jeff, tell us briefly how you got involved in Palestine solidarity activism.
Well, I go back, to the States, as you can hear.
Yes.
I'm not a native Israeli. I've been here for about 40-some years. I came to Israel in 1973 to live. But I'm really a child of the 60s. And I did everything you were supposed to do in the 60s. I grew up with Bob Dylan in Minnesota. I went to Woodstock. I was in the civil rights movement. I was in the anti-war movement. I did everything you were supposed to do. But part of the 60s that people don't really remember too much was going back to roots, to identity. Mm-hmm. Alex Haig had written the book Roots and so on. So in a sense, going back to a certain Jewish identity. I never saw life in the States as being very transcendent, to tell you the truth. I found my way here, but I found my way here not as a Zionist, but, you know, I was from the 60s. So I came with a political disposition to knowing there's an occupation, to sympathy with the Palestinians. In other words, I'm not a story of a Zionist that came rosy-eyed and got disillusioned and found his way to the left. I came on the left, from the left, and I knew that there was always an occupation here. So from the very beginning, in the early 1970s, I was already on the left in Israel, in the peace movement. And, you know, from there I was involved with all kinds of Israeli peace and activist groups over the years, but on the left, you know, on what I call the critical left. Maybe you might call it the non-Zionist left, mm-hmm. Israel. And that's the left that can, not the Zionist left that insists on a two-state solution and Israel has to be a Jewish state, but a non-Zionist or anti-Zionist left that says, yes, you know, I would like to have an Israeli culture here, a Hebrew language, I like the Hebrew university, Hebrew newspapers, literature, and so on, but I can envision living in one democratic country with Palestinians. So for me, Israel doesn't have to be a Jewish state. So that over the years, you know, as when I came in the early 1970s, nobody thought the occupation would last all these years. Mm-hmm. So over the years, things have changed, but I kept my commitment already going back to the 60s to a progressive social change.
Uh-huh. Okay, so tell us what the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions is about. What does it do? How many homes do you rebuild in a given year? And how did you get involved?
Well, you know, like I said, I've been involved with the left for many years. But when the Oslo peace process began in 1993, you know, a lot of us on the left, even though we had some doubts about it, you know, we're hoping it would succeed. You know, we had mm-hmm. also invested, like everybody else, hopes. You know, the sides are meeting, they're negotiating with all the ups and downs. So in a sense, for a number of years, the Israeli peace movement became sort of dormant. You know, to this peace process, 93, 94, 95, Rabin is assassinated at the end of 95, 96, Netanyahu gets elected for the first time. And when he was elected, it was clear that the Oslo peace process was over. And the occupation was reasserting itself in a very brutal way. And so, together with a number of peace people here, we sat down and said, well, look, we have to start to re-engage in resisting the occupation. It is not going away. There's not going to be peace. But what should we do? What should the focus of our work be? And so we went out and spoke to some of our Palestinian colleagues. And the issue of house demolitions came up all the time. And it turns out this is one of the most painful parts of the occupation. At that time, I'm talking now about 1997. Mm-hmm. Israel had demolished about 9,000 homes between the start of the occupation and 1997. In other words, over 30 years, 9,000 homes. And a lot of people had lost their homes, and it was very traumatic for families. And the Palestinians said that would be a good issue to focus on because there's a story of a family. You can advocate for the family. You can tell their story. And you can kind of expose the way the occupation works, because it works through very Kafkaesque mechanisms like yes. planning, zoning, and administration, and so on. So that's what we did. To tell you the truth, today we're up to 40,000 homes that Israel's demolished. So in the 17 years since we started the committee, the number of house demolitions has tripled or quadrupled or something. So it's still an issue that's very much with us. But we began with the idea of resisting demolition, getting in front of houses, getting in front of bulldozers. And slowly over time, the Palestinians got to know who we were. It was a trust relationship, and they'd call us at 5:30 in the morning. I was teaching at the university at that time. And I had to make a decision whether to continue at the university or go full time into this political work because it wasn't something that, you know, that I had control over. Mm-hmm. In other words, it isn't like I could say, all right, every Friday at 10 o'clock, I'm going to go do this. I had to be there. Either you're, you know, when you're working with families and the bulldozers are coming and they're scared and they don't know what to do and they have your number, you have to be available to them. You can't say, yeah. Gee, I have an exam today, call me tomorrow.
Right.
And so, in a sense, I made a decision and I left teaching. I'm an anthropologist. Although I think my anthropology is still very important for the work I do. And we began to resist the demolition of homes. And then we got a little bit of money from people, and we began to rebuild homes that had been demolished as political acts of resistance, mm-hmm. not humanitarian. We're opposed absolutely to mixing humanitarian work. This isn't a matter of good Israelis helping poor Palestinian
right,
victims.
Right, right.
And Palestinians wouldn't work with us if that was the way we worked. So it's political work. Over the years, we've built 187 homes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say 187 out of 40,000. That's a drop in the bucket, or if even that. But if you look at it as 187 joint acts of resistance of Israelis and Palestinians together, mm-hmm. in the light of day, against the army. You know, we don't ask for permission. We don't ask for a building permit. We don't coordinate. We simply go out and build to defy the army. And if they demolish, we rebuild again. Most of our houses remain. But there have been some houses that have been demolished 3, 4, 5, 1, 6 times.
Wow.
And we built it every time. And around that, then, we have people come from all over the world to build with us. So it's a very meaningful international solidarity act. We have the families, some of which know English, go out. We arrange that they go out on speaking tours, mm-hmm. like I do, so they're known. There's films made about them. People come and talk with them. We have tours all the time that go to the homes, and they tell their stories. So we're able to parlay that into a very powerful advocacy tool.
Mm-hmm.
And then around that, since we get to know the lay of the land and how Israel is working and how it demolishes and where is it going with the whole occupation, why is it demolishing,
mm-hmm.
we use that issue as a kind of a window into the occupation. And from that, this is my anthropology, really, we've developed maps and a really grounded, literally grounded analysis of where Israel is going and how can we resolve this conflict. So in a sense, we've gone from resisting the demolition of homes to rebuilding homes to turning the whole issue of house demolitions into a very powerful advocacy tool.
And is there any other way to oppose this Israeli bulldozing of Palestinian homes other than rebuilding?
No, there's no other way. I mean, If, for example, we tried to go to the municipality,
uh-huh.
or the Israeli authorities in the West Bank, the civil administration, as Israel calls its military government, and we tried to get building permits for families, there are organizations that do that. There's an Israeli group called Bimkom, which is a group of planners for human rights.
Mm-hmm.
So they do that. But for our point of view, that wouldn't be political.
Right.
That's buying into the occupation, because Our whole political position is that under the Geneva Conventions, Israel has no authority, no right to plan in the occupied territory, to extend its law into the occupied territory. So we would be undermining, going to the Israeli authorities and saying, look, you're legally responsible. We'd be undermining our own case that
right.
this is occupation, and Israel isn't allowed to do that. Or we could go, for example, to, you know, there's another kind of a direction is to go like Habitat for Humanity.
Right.
And do it the humanitarian way. You know, but then again, it's not, the problem isn't that the Palestinians have suffered from an earthquake
right.
or a fire. The problem is political. And they'll only work with us if we put this within a political framework. So the only political framework is that of resistance.
Uh-huh.
And that's where it makes all the political sense to rebuild the homes, even if they get demolished again, because you're resisting.
Right.
Everything else is a kind of, a kind of a cooperation, collaboration even, mm-hmm. with the occupation, and that we wouldn't do.
When we spoke earlier on the phone, you mentioned that the situation in Palestine has gone beyond apartheid. You used the term warehousing.
That's right.
What is the difference between a warehouse and a ghetto? And is warehousing just one step along the path to concentration camps?
Well, in a sense, the warehousing is the end of the path. Because if you look at concentration camps as kind of a prison, that's really what we're talking about. In other words, the term warehousing comes out of the American prison system. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, the United States has, I don't know, 4 or 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. And they're warehoused. In other words, they're stuck away somewhere. Nobody sees them. Nobody cares about them. They're disappeared. Mm-hmm. They're wards of the state. People don't care because they're bad people anyway, and that's where they should be. And they become a non-issue. And you can do anything you want to them. And if they riot, because you don't use political terminology for prisoners, if they riot, then the guards have every right to put down the riot. In other words, mm-hmm. these are inmates, and right. they have no rights, really. And what we're arguing is that's the way Israel sees the Palestinians. Exactly. They don't see them as another side. This isn't a matter of a conflict, mm-hmm. even. Because with a conflict or a war, you need two sides. There isn't right. two sides. There's an occupying power, one people occupying and denying absolute rights to the other. And Israel has never, ever, ever recognized that there even exists a Palestinian people. Not to say that they've recognized their rights of self-determination, their national rights, the rights to have a country of their own, even if it's a little country next to Israel. None of that. And so, in a sense, it's worse than apartheid where Israel is going. Because in the apartheid regime, at least South Africa acknowledged that there were black Africans. Mm-hmm. The idea was separate development is what they called it. But the very concept of separate means that you saw that there's another side. Here you don't see that at all. Here, you know there's an other, but we call the other Arabs. We don't right. call them Palestinians because we don't want to give that recognition, distinctiveness, legitimacy mm-hmm. to another collective with competing claims to our country. This is the problem. There's an exclusive Jewish Zionist claim to this entire country. And there is no other side. There is no other people. So what do you do now with half the population or more that consists of the other? If they don't have rights, if they're not going to get a state, you're not going to negotiate with them, they're not a side, what do you do with them? They're inmates, basically. I mean, you know they're there. You know, they're not Jews. But you have no place for them. There's no place except for being inmates. So in a sense, I think, and I've written an article about this actually, if you look at Gaza today, what's happening, or you look at the way Israel's completely destroyed the West Bank and the resistance, in a sense, Israel says to the Palestinians, you have three choices. You can submit. In other words, if you recognize, and this is what Netanyahu says, mm-hmm. a precondition for negotiations is that the Palestinians accept Israel not as a state of Israel, but as a Jewish state. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, they give up their claim to the land, they become Zionists, and they submit. And they say, yes, this is a Jewish state. Now would you please let us live some kind of second-class citizenship? If you submit, okay, you can stay. Or you can leave, and Israel tries to push people out. That's one of the ideas behind the house demolition policy. Or you die. Those are your three options. Living in this country as another people with national rights of self-determination in a state of your own is not an option. Mm-hmm. You can submit to us, you can get out, or you die. And that's really what Israel has left the Palestinians with. And that's what we call warehousing. That's very much imprisonment. In other words, the idea is you either submit and you live in little cells. The cells we call areas A and B in the West Bank, about 100 and some little islands on 40% of the West Bank, or little islands even inside Israel. You know, the Palestinian citizens of Israel are 20% of the Israeli population, but they're confined by law to 3.5% of the land. And they get their houses.
They're not allowed to build on that land.
Last year, the Israeli government demolished three times more houses of Israeli citizens, all of whom are Arabs, of course, than they did in the occupied territories. There's one Bedouin community in the Negev Desert that's been demolished 64 times already. And then Gaza. Gaza is this little cage. So those are the cells of the prison. And if you submit and see yourself as an inmate, we'll let you live in these cells and we'll let our economy trickle in a little
bit
you won't be completely impoverished. But that's the best you're going to get. You don't like it, get out.
Yes.
And if you try to resist this, you're going to die.
And you're going to be called a terrorist.
That's in a sense. And you'll be called, and then, of course, the whole thing is framed in terrorism, and they're all terrorists, and all of the Gazans are terrorists. And, you know, it's a framing also that tries to completely delegitimize the Palestinians.
Yes.
So that's, in a sense, what warehousing means. And it's a worse situation than apartheid because it's static.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, when you're in prison, you're not negotiating. There's no movement. There's no political process. You're imprisoned, and that's it, period.
Yeah.
And it's forever. And that's, in a sense, so Israel has really sentenced the Palestinians to life in prison.
Right. Recently, there was an article in Mondo Weiss about how the traffic to the Jewish Voice for Peace website has skyrocketed and gone way past that of the traffic to AIPAC and J Street. We're seeing more and more that Jews outside of Israel are coming out against Israel's policies against the Palestinians. And I feel like now it's really reached a critical mass. There are plenty of Jews out there criticizing the Israeli government, but thinking strategically. And this is the kind of information I'm really trying to get across to the listeners out there. What do you think needs to be done with this vast interest and support?
Right. Well, look, we have a real problem. And that is that we're stuck. You know, on the one hand, Palestine has become, I think, the world issue. I think it's assumed the proportions of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. It's all over the world, and millions of people are involved, and you have BDS campaigns, and even governments are starting to move, the media is starting to move a bit. But the Palestinians, especially our Palestinian partners, more on the left, are stuck between solutions. In other words, for 100 years, the Palestinians have been struggling for a national liberation, meaning a state of their own. And even to the point where they were willing to accept the two-state solution, which gave them 22% of their historic homeland. They were willing to accept that. That's gone. So they know that the two-state solution is gone. But with that goes the national liberation struggle. Because now, if we're shifting to a one-state solution, it's not just a technical shift from one option to another. So, in a sense, we're in a political struggle in which the Palestinian cause is winning, in which they have human rights and international law behind them. In other words, they have a certain wind at their back. They've got the support of the peoples, but we're missing the solution. In other words, we're in a political struggle that in some ways we're winning, but you know, I'm not a Palestinian. And you're not a Palestinian. We can't, we can, I can give my ideas, I write about it and so on, but I have to stop short of advocating. I can't put the cart before the horse, and I have to wait on them. And it's very hard for them. So in a sense, we're in a situation where it's hard to say exactly how we're going to get out of this mess. You know, being sure our governments, you know, trying to have an arms, arms sanctions in Israel, being sure our governments aren't selling arms, being sure our governments aren't supporting Israel and what it's doing, trying to force our governments to implement international law and human rights covenants. That's a part of it. You know, and again, mobilizing civil society, not only in BDS, but I think the churches are starting to speak out, certainly in the United States,
yes.
Trade unions, university groups, Jewish groups around the Jewish Voice for Peace and others. So I think there, I think that movement is there. It's a matter of keeping it going and strengthening it, and I think continuing to have influence. Even though we don't exactly have a solution, an end game,
right,
to sell, and that's very hard.
When I first went to Palestine, I didn't realize what kind of difference one person could make. Obviously, you know, you can't single-handedly end the occupation if you go there, but the things that I did with ISM really made a difference in individual people's lives, like waiting with people at checkpoints who were detained and negotiating with soldiers so that they could get through the checkpoints. That makes a big difference in somebody's life. And we went into Palestinian homes that were invaded by Israeli soldiers, and we followed the soldiers around with cameras and filmed them so that they would not beat up the Palestinians and they would not destroy property. And that made a difference for that one family. So I really want to encourage everybody who's watching this to seriously think about coming to Palestine and doing this kind of work. And so I also wanted to ask you, what do we need to know about how Israel is manipulating the definitions of what constitutes a violation of international law? And what can we do to oppose this process?
Well, you know, the problem is we have instruments at our disposal. We have a lot of covenants of human rights. We have very strong international laws, especially the Geneva Conventions. We have international criminal courts. We have the International Court of Justice in The Hague. There's tribunals built into the Geneva Conventions. the big problem is implementation.
Right.
Because these all exist, except the governments, states, and especially the United States, is able to block the implementation of all these sorts of mechanisms. And that's, I think that's the big problem that we have. We can't work through the UN system very well because the UN, you know, the US has its veto. And in a sense, we're blocked from that point of view. But from that point of view also, I think what's important to realize is that the Israel-Palestine conflict isn't just a localized one. I mean, we have to bring in the rest of the world as well. This is a global conflict. It's not localized between Israelis and Palestinians.
Right.
It has to do with human rights, it has to do with oil, with energy, with security. There's five or six wars being fought here, militarism, and in a sense, you know, this is the test of human rights and international law. Because if in this conflict, which is in the light of day, in the Holy Land, no less, from a religious point of view, on the southern border of Europe, in what's supposed to be the most democratic state in the Middle East, with the television cameras looking everywhere, if the occupation wins, and that's a possibility, if Israel wins and an entire people are imprisoned and warehoused, And if international law is simply trampled on and made a laughingstock, the implications of that are tremendous for people all over the world, for the Congo.
Right.
For peoples for whom the oppressed peoples, the poor people of the world, for whom human rights and international law are the only things they have their fingernails on that might possibly give them a better life. And if, in a sense, the message is that the United States and Europe will prevent international law from being implemented, to prevent the imprisonment and occupation and warehousing of an entire people in the light of day, and prevent the UN from implementing, that's a chilling, chilling message for everybody.
Right.
And not only poor people, the occupied people, you know, the people young people in the U.S. that want the United States to be a part of the world and a better world. So the stakes here are really high. It's much, you know, what's at stake here is much more than simply the Palestinians' future, but really the future of all of us. And I think that's something that has to be really emphasized. One of the problems is that, you know, human rights language is the language of most of the world. It hasn't come to the United States very strongly yet. It's not part of the language that's used. And, of course, there's hostility to the UN and the U.S. Now, the problem is that you have a special problem, because if you're the country that's a superpower, you're on top.
Mm-hmm.
You don't recognize the International Court of Justice in The Hague as the Supreme Court of the world. You don't recognize international law as trumping American law. In other words, if you're on top, you're on top, and there's nothing above you.
Right.
And for the rest of the world, not only is willing but wants to have a superpower that's just. In other words, they want human rights and international law to be the superpower, the way the world works.
Mm-hmm.
The force that would be opposing that would be the existing superpower, that would then feel that its hegemony is being threatened by something bigger. So there's a particular responsibility of Americans in this, because the United States is the power that's able and that is standing in the way of a world in which human rights and international law are the rules of the game. And so, in a sense, what the United States is doing most obviously in terms of the Palestinians and supporting Israel and so on is in microcosm, you know, part of the global problem that we're all facing. So I work with a concept I'm writing about now that I call global Palestine,
mm-hmm.
which I'm trying to make that point that Palestine is the microcosm, but it's really Israel in a sense. Yeah, you know, in the bigger scheme of things, is the United States and the core capitalist powers, and the Palestinians are the rest of the world.
Right.
So what plays out here is playing out in a localized way. The big game for the whole world, and I think we have to sort of try to. We have a slogan in the Israeli peace movement that we're all Palestinians.
Uh-huh.
Mean that in the sense of solidarity.
Right.
Literally, we can say we, the people, are all Palestinians, because you know we're all liable to the same forms of oppression of the corporations and the armies of the West and so on. Look at Ferguson,
right.
Missouri. You know, the militarization of the police. In other words, the Palestinians are the guinea pigs. They're the ones in Gaza that these military new instruments are being tried out on, new weaponry, new tactics. But that's not for the Palestinians. They're no threat to Israel. They're the guinea pigs.
Right.
The end users are you guys, you see? And that's, I think, a point to make, is that we're not asking people to be sympathetic to Palestinians simply because of human rights, simply out of solidarity, because mm-hmm. they're the oppressed, but because it's really your self-interest.
Right.
Because what happens to the Palestinians is going to come back and happen to you in Ferguson and wherever else you are.
Yeah.
And people have to understand that, you know, our our destinies are all tied.
Yeah, that's a really good point you just made. So what can we as Americans do to pressure our government into following international law? I mean, you know, besides writing to our elected representatives,
right,
who are just
right.
really in the pockets of AIPAC, and it's very frustrating.
Well, but you know, I think there's a misreading of things that gets us more depressed than we should be.
Okay.
And then we see our governments. We measure how well we're doing by our governments.
Uh-huh.
In other words, Israel feels, in terms of Gaza now, that it's winning. Israel is very happy because all the governments, including Egypt, support it. They don't see the people. You see, the peoples of the world don't support Israel. Israel is missing, I think, the people. That there's been a groundswell of change in public opinion. And the way it works is, you know, we're used to our governments leading. We see them as the leaders, and we measure how we're doing by what the government's positions are, because, mm-hmm. you know, they negotiate, they sign the treaties, they've arrogated to themselves the right to run our international relations and our wars.
Yeah.
So we're kind of stuck with them. But they're the last ones that are going to fall into place. That's what I'm trying to say. What I'm saying is that this is going to hit them. It's going to kind of blindside them, in the sense that there's a tremendous change in public opinion. And like I said, you know, churches and trade unions and political groups, university groups and Jewish groups, and there's a groundswell happening, but it takes a while to percolate up. You know, we don't have we the people, we don't have the media, we don't have the money, we don't have AIPAC,
mm-hmm.
we don't have operations, you know, so it takes us a while to break through all that stuff. But I think it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think what we have to take heart in a way is to say, look, we're in a process of changing the political map.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's happening all over the world, and it's trickling up. And as members of Congress, I've met so many members of Congress that say to me, I'm with you. You don't have to convince me. I read the newspapers, I know. But I want to get reelected.
Oh, my God.
So once they see that, I'll give you the colorful example. I met with Barney Frank once.
I actually wanted to interview Keith Ellison about this for this interview series, but I can't get in touch with him.
Well, I'm going to be in Minnesota soon, so I can maybe I can do that.
Oh, that would
be
great.
I'll be in his district in October. I know him a little bit, so maybe I can help you with that. Because I know people that know him.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, Barney Frank is this colorful ex-congressman from Newton, Massachusetts, near Boston. Big Jewish constituency. He says, I'm with you. I agree with you. You don't have to convince me. But I want to get reelected. So if you bring me the names of 5,000 Jewish constituents in my district that agree with you, tomorrow morning I've changed my position and I'm with you. That's
wow.
the promise, you see. The problem
right.
isn't the merits of the case. The problem is that they're reading, I think their readings are getting to be more and more wrong. Because I think the Palestinian issue is becoming an issue, and there is a change. So as this begins to happen, and politicians begin to feel that they do have to begin to respond because of public opinion, I think things will move much faster. And don't forget, you know, you get to that tipping point. And the tipping point often comes faster than you think. You know, these unjust regimes, not only Israel with the occupied territories, you think of South Africa. You think of the Shah in Iran. You think of Marcos in the Philippines. The Soviet Union. You know, Poland with Lech Walesa and so on. All these places were very strong until all of a sudden, boom, the last minute, the whole thing collapses. And nobody could have predicted it. And I think we have to look towards that collapse. We have to work towards uh-huh. that collapse, towards that tipping point. So, again, to take heart a little bit, it doesn't mean working for another you know, slowly, slowly, incrementally for another 20 or 30 years. It means getting to a point that I think we're getting there where it starts to collapse.
Yeah, wow, that was an amazing story you told about Barney Frank.
Yes.
That was his name. Wow, I mean, I've written so many letters to elected representatives, and I just, you know, get this kind of Zionist sympathetic form letter back. And I wonder if they have, you know, some number in the back of their head, you know, at 5,000 for Barney Frank, what are the numbers for the other people, and how do we get there, and what they will actually do when we do get there, if they will follow through, or, and do you think it's just they want the names of their Jewish constituents? I mean, that's just, that's so problematic in so many ways.
Well,
it's like
it depends where you are.
The rest of the people don't count.
Yeah, but the Christian fundamentalists are just as nuttily pro-Israel as the Jews are.
Yeah, that's true.
You can be in northwestern Idaho with no Jews in your district, and you still have Christian fundamentalists to deal with.
Yeah.
So you have to see in your district, you know, who you're talking about. But look, even if that's the way politics work, even if a member of Congress does support Israel, if they want to get reelected, and we've succeeded in working in their district to change public opinion, they're going to go the way their constituents want, even if they don't want to. So I think that's, to tell you the truth, I've been trying to get the U.S. campaign for a while to do something. And it's something you could do in each state, maybe.
And this is the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation?
Yeah, the U.S. campaign is great. They have 220 organizations, and they do lobbying. But I think what we should do is, for example, find out who, and it would take 2 minutes to do it, who the 20 or 30 most powerful members of Congress are.
Uh-huh.
By district, by seniority, by party, by committees that they're on, by clout, you know, and begin to target their constituencies. And the problem is, when I go on speaking tours, I go to the same places like everybody else does. I go to New York and Boston and Chicago and L.A. and sometimes maybe Seattle. And, you know, but the most powerful members of Congress might be from southeast Missouri.
Uh-huh.
Where more rural areas where the seniority, you know, they're in Congress for 30 years.
Right.
You know, in other words, if we look at who the chairs of the different committees are and who the people are with clout, they're not always people from the most,
they're often
people from places that we never get to.
Right.
But if you go work through their churches, here the Presbyterian Church voted for divestment, the Methodists are very good, and a lot of the other churches, you know, so if we can work through local churches to work in their districts of whoever these people of influence are, you know, and if some member of Congress goes back to his or her district in central Kansas, and in their district, in their local office, now here comes a delegation of 20 local people with some ministers and maybe a rabbi or two, and some prominent people from their district that say, look, we really are concerned about Palestine. Whoa, that begins to make an impact. If they see at home that there's that constituency, that's what makes, I think, the biggest difference. So I think there has to be a more systematic approach to working with members of Congress and mobilizing local communities in all kinds of ways, and especially, again, among members of Congress that might be influential but not in very prominent areas,
maybe
not in urban areas.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of that kind of work to do, and I think it could be very effective.
Well, thank you very, very much, Jeff. Thank you for those great ideas. Very inspiring. And this is Jeff Halper from the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Check out their website. What is your website?
www.ICAHD.org, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions.org.
Okay, thank you very, very much, Jeff.
Okay, all right, thanks for having me on.
Again, this Palestinian Telesummit is hosted by Katie Miranda, katiemiranda.com. We did go way over because, as I said, Jeff Halper is a friend of mine, personal bud, and I do not keep tabs with him like I probably should, but he is a very, very busy man. We each have our own venues of activity and activism. He lives in Israel, although, as he declared, he'll be visiting Minnesota soon, where I lived for 35 years and where he was born, up on the range there. My apologies for totally forgetting to give out the phone number. I keep thinking, gee, why didn't someone call me and tell me to give out the phone number? Like, really, tip of my brain's tongue there, isn't it? For that matter, remember that if I ever forget again, you can always go to our website, freakradio.org, go to the contact link, click on the contact link there, and lo and behold, the studio number is right before you. We went way over. Thank you for listening. We heard the entire Katie Miranda hosted interview with Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Join me next Monday at 3 p.m. and, of course, Saturday for the interview with Greta Berlin, 11 a.m., 1100 hours Pacific time, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Ta-ta. Where are you?